Yeah, thanks for that description. That interests me in a couple of ways. And one of them is that one time in a retreat, I heard Richard Baker Roshi give an instruction that was like that, suggesting that people try feeling their breath sort of filling from below, coming up, and then on the exhalation, flowing back down in front like that and making that oval. So that's really interesting. That was just your observation of where it went for you. And I'm loving how, because we're together, we can hear each other's experiences of how, of what can happen from a few words being dropped into your meditation. Whether you decide to try to do whatever that was, or just let those words come enter into your meditation, then there is a kind of there is a way in which, at least it feels to me, here we are individually, collectively experiencing our individual responses within a meditation. And there's something just sweet about that, about witnessing with and for each other. So I'm going to go on with the koan a little bit. We'll see where that goes. But I would like you to feel free to interrupt. If there's something, just raise your hand or let me know if there's something you'd like to stop with as I go along. So sort of back in the koan, where Nan Chuan says, if you try to turn toward it, you'll move farther away. What came up for me very much there was almost, I started to laugh because this time I met this, what ordinary mind, is there any place where you wouldn't meet it? Is there some place else to go to find your ordinary mind? I mean, it's kind of a funny idea, right? It's almost like, if you're I'm thinking someone this morning, Zina, who can't be there this afternoon, but whose recording will be available soon, talked about her experience with this koan or with just ordinary mind. And one of the things she said was it kind of felt like holding that stone drenched with rain at the North Pole. You know, so where are you going to go if you're trying to find north? You know, where are you going to go? And so I have that feeling about this. You know, if you're trying to find your ordinary mind, where do you think you're going to go? You know, what would you, where would there be to turn? You know, you could spin, I guess. And so it's here, it's you, right? But that question that Jiaojiao asks is so much our question, right? Where, how should I try to direct myself toward it? He's really asking, what is this practice in a way, right? And so he gets that response. And then how can I know the Tao if I don't turn toward it? So it's a fair question, isn't it? if you and actually that it above where Nanchuan answered didn't it really could apply to mind, ordinary mind or Tao, because he's saying ordinary mind is the Tao. But in any case, Zhaozhou's question is then how can I know the Tao? If I don't turn toward it. And in a way, there's a kind of really what other way, if I don't go looking, what other way is there to see? And it's that clarity, it's that desire for clarity that we've talked about, isn't it? I'd like to see my mind, please. I'd like to see this ordinary mind, if you're telling me it's the way. And so how can I know it? That's that question that's from here, right? And when I suggested that first part of the meditation, in a way, I was there with Zhaozhou, right? How can I know it? Let's try to look at it. Let's try to see it. Let me see my mind, my ordinary mind. And so Nanchuan replies, Tao doesn't belong to knowing or not knowing. So he's doing this beautiful kind of surgical slice where he's saying, wait, look what you've already done, right? You have already made it be something else. You've already made it be somewhere else. By thinking that your project is to know it. And don't we all go there? If I could just really know my mind, if I could just really know my ordinary mind, then I could fix it so it would feel like the Tao, because I don't feel like it's it. And so by sort of interrupting that process for us, Nanchuan saying, well, what about what? In a way, he's saying it doesn't belong to knowing or not knowing. In a way, he's saying, wait, you've still got too small a project. You're still trying to make the practice do work for you, right? You're trying to make it get you to the place where you can have a clear look. Your ordinary mind will stand still for you. You can get a good look at this elusive creature, and won't you feel better then? And so knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. So then he's doing that really important move for us, I think. This is what it feels like to me, is that he is helping me bump my head against the wall. He is helping me come to the edges of what I, and notice the confine of what that I've put myself into. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is blankness. And then I'm going, bonk, you know, then what? Because, oh, there's something else other than this room that I've put myself in, my meditation room. You know, what I've decided meditation is, whether I've done any before or not, I've already decided what it is. And if I've done it for 30 years, I've definitely decided what it is. And so what about that? And so this is where I really love where Ikkyu goes. And I wrote it down because I didn't want to have to look at it on the screen. those cherries, right? Those cherry blossoms of Yoshino, which will bloom in the spring. If we cut the tree open to find them, where would they be? So do you see how he's going to a similar place? You think if you just cut open the trunk of your live mind that stretch with roots down into the unknown and branches reaching into the unknown, your live tree changing moment by moment by moment, responding to circumstances, connecting underground, connecting in the sky, transforming what every experience it has into a life form. If you want to cut your mind open and see if you can find what thought's going to come from it next, well, good luck. Right? Something, this approach might have its limitations. So then he's not going to just leave us there. He's really wanting to help young Zhaozhou. And what he's saying is, okay, you've reached the limitations of this realm in which you're trying to solve the problem, in which you're trying to find a response to your question. So what if the response does not lie in that realm of knowing and not or not knowing? But what if there's another realm in which you can have an experience of this? And we don't always talk about realms, but the sutras are full of discussions about realms. And if this felt like a realm sort of a place to me. So Nanchuan says, if you truly reach the genuine Tao, and so here he's been talking about don't try to turn towards it, right? So then what kind of reaching could that be? The only way I can understand that is for him to be saying, well, when you are experiencing the genuine Tao, when you are it, when you are in it, when you are being it, when you are completely permeated by it and expressing it with everything that you do, because that's all there is, in that, if you reach that genuine Tao, when you notice how it really is, which was what I was trying to invite in that second part of the meditation, just inhabit it, just let yourself fall into it and be it and see what that's like, not rather than trying to get anywhere. He says it's vast and boundless as outer space. Nothing about accomplishment there at all. He's just saying, it's so big. You'll feel it, you'll notice it, because there's no directionality to vast and boundless as outer space. There's no coming or going. There's only just this. Only just this. This room, you know, stripy flowered wallpaper from 1884. And so he says, if you truly reach the genuine Tao, and I always just find myself wanting to replace the ifs with when, because you do, because it's already your nature. You already know this territory. When you allow yourself the experience of this genuine Tao that is you and that is what it is to be here, it's big. It's big. So if you just allow yourself not to be looking small, not to be confining it, if you allow yourself to imagine how big it is, boom, because it is that big and you have that experience of how big. So he says, then how can we talk about that at the level of right or wrong? And again, if you don't see that as an admonishment, but really a question, right? When you're in this experience, when you are in this experience, it is so big. It is so much just itself. It is so much just this screen in front of you with beloved faces, all of us engaged in being as we are, and the longing to be of benefit in a world of suffering. How can we talk about that at the level of right or wrong? It just kind of doesn't apply. It suddenly becomes very small and banal and boring. Are you interested in it at the level of right or wrong when you really ask yourself? So why, it's an interesting question to me. Why do I and do you, because we all do, interrupt our experience of here, our experience of the meditation, our experience of breakfast, our experience of holding the baby? Why do we interrupt it with questions that are at the level of right and wrong? They're boring. But it's not a rhetorical question, it's a real question. Why? And I think when I ask it that way, and then I have to say to myself, because those questions about right or wrong are also something that my mind does. They also are ordinary mind. So they are also not right or wrong. The questions of right or wrong are not right or wrong. They have their own place in the firmament of my mind. And can I have some kindness towards them? But what he's saying is, when it comes to this question about what's the Tao, the fundamental nature of it, then it's just your ordinary mind, and we don't need that stuff about right or wrong at that moment. It's a different question. It's a different realm. Is that making any sense? I'm a little bit worried about getting abstract and boring. So then the verse comes along as a kind of, okay, so just try this, you know? Just try this as a description of how it is. Spring flowers, the moon in autumn, the cool breezes of summer, winter snow. When idle concerns don't cloud your mind, that is your best season. I can just feel, I'm feeling it in myself, but I almost feel like I feel it in you too, this collective sigh of just like, ah. Spring flowers, the moon in autumn, the cool breezes of summer, winter snow. When idle concerns don't cloud your mind, that is your best season. Well, the interesting thing here is the only idle concerns we've been talking about are what is the Tao, right? There isn't any other idle concern that's been mentioned. And So it's so great because it's like, well, and there were other questions too, right? Like, should I try to direct myself toward it? Idle concern, guys. And it's, and which is really, it's okay. That's our hearts. That's the voice of our hearts yearning. Yeah. So this is not saying don't ever have idle concerns, is it? And and so this is, again, so easy for us to take that verse as an ideal state that we should all aspire to, right? But didn't we just hear something about not aspiring to it, about not trying to direct ourselves towards it? And so it's a kind of if it's not that, then what is your experience of that verse? And so I wanted to bring in there just that sense of sort of coming back to, and this is going to connect a little bit with the note that you sent out, Martha, and I want to invite you to say some things about that yourself. But I found this kind of a little litany or the tune, ordinary mind is the way, my ordinary mind is the way, this ordinary mind is the way, your ordinary mind is the way. And I think we'll go back into meditation in a little bit to look at how how they feel a little differently with respect to not trying. And they're just a little different. They feel a little different to me. And I just found that kind of interesting. So some of you know, because I've been mentioning it, that I finished reading the book about the Harston family. And so that's still very much with me, this family that includes the ancestors of people who enslaved thousands. Of captives from Africa and their children and their children's children and their children's children's children and the families of those descendants of those children and children's children children and the ultimate connections and reconnections and ties those two families have made, not at all by ignoring, but by researching and acknowledging what was done, what happened. And what it really was stunning to me at the end of this book by an author who did an enormous amount of research on these families was his love, was the ache of his heart for all of that suffering and all of the suffering that it continues to engender. That was written in 1999, but I found an interview with him that I haven't gotten to watch yet from last year, from 2020. But the ache of it, he didn't think that was what he was going to find when he first met representatives with these two families. He didn't realize, he didn't know how the hugeness of the evil, of the harm, and the stunning complexity of relationships into the present and ongoing. And what you feel is his love, and his not forming conclusions. So reading that and then having the sheer delight of being with my granddaughter and being in this territory that I love, of being by the ocean, walking on these great rocks that were scraped by glaciers that were formed way, way, way before that, as the continents. And Joe's been reading about the geology of the area and talking to me about the ancient movements of the magma and of and then we walk on these rocks that are have sort of like toboggan runs grooved into them by glaciers. And then this little person, you know, who will have a life that will mostly happen after I die. And so why would there not be room for all of that? Why would there not be room for what do we do now? This really, really long process of reparation and reconciliation and learning each other and wearing out the old enmities. Why would we not be concerned with what's our part in that? And why would we not simply sit on a rock, watch a baby pat an ancient rock? What part of mind would we like to exclude? And how bizarre is it that we would like to cut part of it off? So I've been talking for quite a while here. And I think I would like to just quickly touch on a couple of points you made, Martha, if you don't mind. Respond a little. I don't know if everybody got to read what Martha sent out. Raise a finger or something like that? So some of you got to read it and some of you haven't yet. About idle concerns and ordinary mind. You know, that experience that's kind of like, looking at clouds from both sides now, yeah, from up and down and still somehow. And noticing how thoughts are repetitive. And then how an obsessive quality changes that, the experience of the repetitive thought. So I wanted to pick up on that for a second. Because in the light of what I've just been talking about, that the repetitive thoughts, the thoughts that keep coming back, of course, for one thing, they're not repetitive in that each time it's a little bit different. It's the thought of right now and not the thought of 10 minutes ago, but still the theme comes back and there's some quality of it that comes back. And I was thinking that obsessive quality, I'm wondering if it has to do with when a thought insists on itself. What's that? When it insists on recurring, what is that? And what if I'm just curious about that? Rather than trying to turn towards some other state where that's not happening. And that's not what I felt you doing, turning towards some other state, but I was just thinking about when it feels obsessive. And we know that we can feel the space open when we're not trying to fix anything. Is the obsessive quality maybe coming from an internal argument, some aggression in the mind? And this is something Trungpa Rinpoche writes about a lot, and I think it's really helpful to notice an aggressive stance when I'm having an aggressive stance towards my own mind. And it can be very subtle. But if I have an internal argument that's saying you should be noticing the scent of the seaweed or the taste of an oyster, you know, why are you thinking about, will they notice that I'm enjoying this, you know, this oyster that they brought me as a treat, you know, I'm thinking, will they notice this rather than simply tasting it? But it's not an either or. I am simply tasting it, the delight of it, and I am wondering how to show that delight, how to express it to people that I love. And so if I'm not having an argument with myself about which thought I should allow, then maybe that's my best season. And who sets the scale of importance of thoughts? You know, how do we set up our little measurement system? This thought is important. This thought is not important. And what about how sweet it is when we don't have to? So there was that. And and then this wonderful nomenclature of clouds really made me think about, which you'll find in the note that Martha sent, if you haven't gotten to look at it yet, there's this really delightful, extensive nomenclature of clouds. And I thought, what about a nomenclature of idleness? I want to make a nomenclature of idleness. I want to make a nomenclature of delight. People have made nomenclatures of mental states, but they're Latin-based and they are like categorizing according to a system designed to answer the questions of the scientists, right? The categories are made by someone for a purpose. But so it's like the map made by the colonizer's cartographer will be designed to divide the space into governable units. The map made by the person who wishes to reach Zion will probably have an extensive description of Zion and then an invitation to be there. You know, it's going to be a very different kind of map. And so what's our nomenclature? Of delight. What's our nomenclature of freedom? What about all the different kinds of freedom? Wouldn't it be fun to write all the different kinds of freedom? And so I have one more thing I think I'll end with. So I'd like to open up for discussion, for conversation now, and then, because we have quite a bit more time. Well, just raise your hand if you want a few minutes of meditation first, or if you'd like to have and the other alternative is to have some conversation and then drop into the meditation. So who would like meditation first? Okay, it looks like most of you are saying you'd rather do, it's almost a split, but it looks like a little bit more, let's have a little conversation but maybe not too much. And then we'll go into meditation. Okay. So if whoever said they'd like conversation first, better speak up.